Hello and welcome to Central Asian Podcast Majlis. I'm Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. It's not unusual for politics and business to be family affairs in Central Asia. In Kazakhstan, we have seen in the past the president appointing his son-in-law to lead the strong KGB and recently appointed his daughter to serve as the deputy prime minister. Similar example of unprecedented nepotism in the president's families are seen both in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. But President Emomali Rahmon of Tajikistan, who has 7 daughters and 2 sons, is taking nepotism to a new height. Among others, he has recently appointed his daughter as head of his presidential administration, while her husband is shadow finance minister. Under the current president, we have seen some surge of a similar nepotism pattern in Turkmenistan. Today in this panel, we plan to discuss the increasing tendency of nepotism, elements triggering this pattern, the past consequences of such moves and potential future consequences on the ground. To discuss the subject, I have from Bishkek Steve Sverdlow, the Human Rights Watch Central Asia researcher. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
From London, Alisher Ilhamov, researcher at the London School's Oriental and African Studies. Alisher, welcome to the show.
Hello.
From Washington, D.C., Catherine Putz, Central Asia editor at The Diplomat, is joining us. Cathy, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
From Prague, here in the studio, Bruce Panier, editor of Kshlak Owazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is with me. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for being in the show, ladies and gentlemen. First, let's do some reality check on the ground. Rahmon of Tajikistan is obviously a champion in nepotism race in Central Asia. How far he has gone? I mean, how his family tree looks like in the governmental structure of Tajikistan? Steve, do you want to pick the subject?
Well, as you noted in your intro, this last week or so, we've seen some shuffling around the government. His daughter is now going to be chief of staff of the presidential administration. And earlier, we saw a recent legislative change that was brought through parliament, which would lower the age eligibility for running for president from the age of 35 to 30. And there's been some speculation that that was done specifically for his oldest son, Emomali Rahmon, who is now 28 years old. It is, of course, difficult to get into the minds of the Central Asian rulers, because at the time that Emomali could run, other legislative amendments that are currently under consideration would allow Emomali Rahmon, the president, to actually run again and again as long as he wants, if these current amendments that are being considered will be approved. So, you know, it could be that President Rahmon is keeping his options open. But what it does, of course, is it sends a terrible signal to the civil society, to, you know, all Tajiks who are really looking at trying to see how their country is going to unfold. And of course, this is also happening against the backdrop of a quite dramatic deterioration in the human rights situation. We've had all the viable political opposition in Tajikistan essentially put behind bars just in the span of a few months' time. Hundreds of people from the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan have landed behind bars. And meanwhile, abroad, Tajik exiled political figures that could have not necessarily contested power, but at least raised questions about Tajikistan's democratic destiny or potential have really actually been detained, and in some cases more dramatic circumstances, like the head of the Group 24 political opposition movement, Umar Ali Kovatov, was gunned down and killed in Istanbul earlier in 2015. So you see, at the same time as, you know, a remarkable nepotism that's taking place, you see a cleaning of the house, politically speaking, which is dangerous for human rights and has many ramifications.
Right. Bruce, let's talk a little bit before going to other subjects. How many members of Emomali Rahmon is currently serving in the government positions, in which levels?
You know, I mean, they're dispersed all over the place, more than a dozen for sure. You know, and I would add to that I think we might have seen this before, except for the fact that his children had to get a little bit older before they could actually take up some of these positions. But if you want to count in the relatives by marriage, the relatives, you know, and not just through his wife, but his children have married people or married into other families. Beg Zuhura, for instance, is a classic example. His son is was the minister of communications, and his son married one of Rahman's daughters, so that kind of sealed the inner circle a little bit more. So yeah, I mean, it could even be two or three dozen now. It's hard to track them all because they're all over the place.
I see. While you're talking, you have in fact a paper showing the family tree of Imam Ali Rahman. I see Imam Ali Rahman in the middle of that chart. So if you go through that, what are the other guys in the leaves connect to that picture?
Well, let's see. We also have his nephew, Davlati Saidov, who is also a first deputy prime minister of Tajikistan. We have another one that through another relative through marriage, which is Amanullah Hukmatullah, who is now no longer working as the head of the railroad after his son got into a big scandal where he had actually killed someone in vehicular manslaughter and was up on charges. And then Hukmatullah was famous for the fact that he said he lashed out at the media and said that they had no place investigating what was happening in his family or what was happening with his son. Yeah, like I said, I could go on and on with this list, and it doesn't even end. I don't have enough paper. An A4 piece of paper wouldn't copy all these people who are related to Rahman. So it's quite a sizable list. You know, it looks more like a corporation.
Right. Alisher, how this nepotism thing started in Central Asia, as far as my knowledge helps me, we have seen like Akayev bringing some of his immediate family members to the government circle. Then Nazarbayev started that with his son-in-law, Rahat Aliyev, being appointed as a head of Kazakhstan's KGB, equivalent of KGB. How did this thing start in Central Asia, if we go back a little bit to the history?
So I see some kind of connections, the links to the the economic basis and the dominating mode of production in those countries, which is very much kind of dominated by the agriculture, by the big ratio of rural population, where we see the more kind of widespread the so-called extended families. So, and this very much actually household-based economy. And so now, actually, we see the household economy and actually, to some extent, household-based system of governance. There's minor differences between those countries. For instance, if Islam Karimov actually has a urban background, he's grown up in living in urban area, relatively better educated, as well as, for instance, Nazarbayev, while, Rahmonov, he came relatively recently, and he actually grown up in the rural area and brought some perspective, pattern of lifestyle, relationship, and actually brought the whole his extended family to the capital, and now actually trying to kind of employ each of them. So it's actually all this kind of type of intra-household, intra-family relationship being now extended to the state government institutions. So this is just minor differences. So while all this kind of promotion of the relatives and the nepotism actually into the government, this is actually quite common for all these countries and where the authoritarian style and the mode of governance has been actually rooted deeply into this tradition, the ways how the state and society being run by the government.
Mm-hmm. Alisha, you put it very interestingly. What did you say? Household system of government. Household system of the government. So
household,
in this case, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan is an interesting case to me. Now, the same trend seems to continue in Kazakhstan. I'm talking about nepotism. While the recent leaders in Kyrgyzstan have halted back a little bit, what's going on there? Why Nazarbayev does continue and Atambayev is not following the legacy of his predecessors, Catherine?
I think the sort of difference that you see between the way nepotism sort of networks are working in Kazakhstan versus Kyrgyzstan has a lot to do with sort of the historical context. So Kyrgyzstan has had a handful of revolutions every few years, and there's sort of been change in power. So there has been shift in terms of which members of the elite are at the top of that pile. And you don't have that in Kazakhstan. You don't have as much shifting. And so I think in a lot of ways, that has drawn ire towards previous presidents in Kyrgyzstan, that their sons had corrupt dealings. And so I think it's sort of a holding back from falling into that trap in a way. It also kind of it helps illustrate this sort of different level of development in terms of democratic institutions. And so you still have corruption in Kyrgyzstan, but it's not at the same level, I would say, as Kazakhstan. At least it's not as tied to the elite as it is in Kazakhstan.
Do we understand correctly, Steve, this case with Atambayev, that he's not as much as into this nepotism thing compared to other Central Asian countries or compared to the previous presidents in the country in Kyrgyzstan?
You know, I think we don't know. Obviously, there are a lot of corrupt dealings, and there's constantly good reporting, a lot of muckraking. I think journalism, maybe the difference here is that there's also a little bit more of a vibrant civil society. I know that there was a minor scandal that emerged around Atambayev's dealings with a Moldovan oligarch. That seems like a timely topic to be bringing up, given what's happening there. But concerning some kickbacks and the duty-free zone at the airport. And, you know, that was raised by activists on Twitter who were able to talk about corruption. So I think Catherine is absolutely right that there's certainly more of, you know, just a much more vibrant media and a human rights community and actually even an Office of Transparency International that's able to work here and raise these issues. And, you know, one has to say that Human Rights Watch comes at this from a different perspective, but I can say that when Prime Minister Atambayev a few years ago was in office, you know, one could sense at least that there was a lot of concern about any evaluations that the post 2010 government was corrupt. There was a really strong yearning and striving, I think, to paint a portrait of serious, true reform. And you know, to some extent, that has been borne out. But on the other hand, there's been Kel Dubekov. You know, there have been a number of cases. There's been public cases concerning the former prosecutor general, Salyanova. But, you know, again, we come at this from a human rights perspective. But I think generally when there's a stronger rule of law, which there is in Kyrgyzstan, there's going to be less cronyism and corruption.
Now, we spoke about Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, a little bit Uzbekistan, but in Turkmenistan, you have an opposite situation compared to Kyrgyzstan here, Bruce. Former President Niyazov, with all of his atrocities, he did one thing that he did not bring extended family members to the government positions. Why Niyazov did not follow the legacy, which is very much common in rest of his colleagues among Central Asian presidents?
There's two things that are probably play a role in this. First, of course, we know that Niyazov was an orphan. You could make the same argument about Karimov, although he wasn't actually as much an orphan as he was basically abandoned by his parents. But Niyazov was legitimately an orphan, so he wouldn't have grown up with a strong sense of family. And the other thing that played a big role in this is, although he had a son, it was very clear early on that his son was rather an irresponsible character. And the story that I always remember about his son, whose name I can't even remember, but he managed to lose £8 million gambling in Monte Carlo in one night. You know, so this is not somebody that you want to follow in your footsteps. And, you know, I mean, basically he'd give the farm away at that point. So, you know, the Turkmen people and probably history are fortunate that the son just seems to have been so irresponsible and so ill-suited to wear the mantle of leadership that he was never even considered for the post. As you point out, Berdimuhamedov's a different story entirely. And we see that things have changed quite a bit. The interesting figure is Berdimuhamedov's son, who we don't see very much or hear very much about. He seems to have brought up the grandson, who's of course far too young to even be considered for president for 20 years practically. But of course there's the rumblings that it's actually the son that is.
Yeah, that's interesting. We don't know exactly in which post he is, but he is in this or that ministry in Ashgabat. And that is just one thing. The other thing is we also know from the leaked information that was coming out from WikiLeaks last year, I believe, that Berdimuhamedov's son-in-law was the country's representative on energy issues in London. We also heard later that he called back or dismissed something like that, but then again, it's unconfirmed information that Berdi Muhammedov's sister is also very, very active in the business circle of Ashgabat. What is developing, Alisher, in Turkmenistan? The examples that I just gave, when you compare it with the rise of the daughter of your own president, Islam Karimov, what kind of comparison you can make between these two countries and the way it is developed or developing?
If to kind of continue this point of kind of the role the personal and family backgrounds play in the way how the authoritarian regimes in Central Asia are building up, we see the two different patterns. One is heavily focused and based on kind of in both cases and we see the search for the, you know, the loyalty base for the authoritarian rulers, but they pursuing this role slightly differently. You know, in Tajikistan, bluntly, straightforwardly bringing own relatives, kings to the government, thereby kind of creating own kind of power base. While in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, we see this, as was mentioned, this Karimov and Niyazov were orphans at the time, but actually didn't have extended family network, which they would be kind of identifying themselves, that they're being forced to kind of forge razor alliances and creating kind of a system of check and balances, informal check and balances, and always kind of trying to somehow kind of to manage and to rotate those alliances which whom they would actually build their kind of relationship. So in Uzbekistan, we see this periodic rotations of the people who would be kind of standing close to Karimov. Because he would never kind of trust fully to his, immediate, staff members or the associates. He would actually undertake periodic purges and bringing new people to the government, and then actually again playing a kind of divide and rule game with all of them, actually posing one camp, one faction against another. This is the way how they managing kind of to retain the grip of power. While in Tajikistan, we see kind of blunt, straightforward nepotism. So this kind of differences play a certain role in the way how these things being there.
I was just going to mention that Alisher is absolutely right in how he describes this rotation, the system of rotation. And you see, you know, for example, the current foreign minister of Uzbekistan, who's now been in that job a few years already, was in that job about 15 years ago. And, you know, there's been the same players periodically move, but the one person that Karimov couldn't keep a handle on and keep the lid on and control adequately was his daughter. By far the most interesting and aberrational, I guess, example of his system of governing is Gulnara Karimova.
Interesting point. You're shaking your head, Bruce.
I agree that with the rotation and stuff, it's
interesting.
It seems like I would also point out that the harder the economics times are getting much harder, and we all know that. But that combined with the question of impending succession seem to be fueling a lot of this nepotism, where the leadership in these countries seems to be, when they do, once they're reaching this point where they're thinking about succession or the hard times are setting in, they seem to feel that the only ones they can trust are the people really, really close to them at this point. And since they've shuffled people, as Steve mentioned, all the time, that leaves you with basically your family and just a few individuals. Steve could have mentioned Inayatov also as being someone who's been a political survivor and clearly has got some hold on Karimov, or Karimov has some hold on him. I would think the former is probably the case. But I think that's also one of the things that's prompting the shifts that we're seeing suddenly in Kazakhstan and even in Tajikistan, is there's a question of loyalty here that obviously the presidents of Tajikistan and Kazakhstan are not entirely comfortable with at the moment.
That's interesting comment, Bruce. Katie, do you also see this connection between the aging leaders of Central Asia and their efforts to bring some of the immediate family members to the top positions? What kind of connection do you see there?
I would totally agree. It's essentially a form of power consolidation. That's pretty clear. And as these leaders get older and they get closer to, a time when they will not be in charge, because presumably they'll be dead, I don't see any of them really handing over the keys to the kingdom. They're starting to think about, well, who's next? And because the systems that they've put in place are sort of nominally democracies, they hold elections, but there's no practice in terms of handing over the power to somebody else. And because so much of the government is run by this network of son-in-laws and cousins and things like that, I would say there's not confidence in terms of how smooth the transition would go to somebody who's not, you know, doesn't have their picture in every classroom in the country. And you see this in you know, to go to the other end of Asia, North Korea did this two times. And it's always been sort of to the sun, and then that person's pictures are then in all of the buildings, but it doesn't necessarily going to work out as smoothly, and it decidedly hasn't gone well for the people of North Korea, and it's not going to go well for the people of Central Asia either, I think.
Thank you, Katie. The politics behind all this nepotism is to strengthen either the president's power or, create a pathway to a succession and everything. But there are examples and times, but did not work the way it was planned. So let's take a short break here. But when we come back, we will discuss that what happens when it does not go the way it is planned. Welcome back. The dictatorships in Central Asia have many faces. The nepotism is one of them. The fact that those leaders stick to power until their death or until being taken down by a force is another sign of authoritarianism. And then you see those leaders adopting strange policies and even stranger titles for themselves. As discussed in the first half, obviously nepotism is one of the shared problems in Central Asia. The nepotism continues despite some of the recent negative consequences. We are discussing the subject today with Steve Sverdlou, Human Rights Watch Central Asia researcher, Ali Sherilkhamov, researcher at the London School's Oriental and African Studies, Catherine Putz, the Central Asia editor at The Diplomat, and Bruce Pioneer, editor of Kishlak Owazi, Araf Yarel's Central Asia blog. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service. Ali Sher, let's begin with you. Presidential family in Uzbekistan has seen some of the worst family feud in the region. As a result, President daughter, as you mentioned in the first half of the show, who once served in the prestigious positions outside of the country in various embassies, even being a representative of Uzbekistan to a UN body, and she suddenly deprived of everything she gained. And we know the outcome turned out to be a nasty battle. Where did it start? How it started?
She just went out of control, at a certain period of time, probably Karimov saw her as a possible kind of, successor to her power. Actually, he could have in mind the example of, for instance, the Aliyev families in Azerbaijan, and probably how it did work well from authoritarian rule point of view. And so until a certain period of time, probably he also considered as an option for Uzbekistan to elder daughters to succeed the power. But after a while, he realized that she is not being assets are raising kind of liability for him, not only kind of bringing some embarrassment to him as a leader who kind of would willing to see the embodying some certain qualities quite comfortable for the traditional kind of patriarchal point of view, but even kind of a certain threat coming from Gulnara himself as a president. So the risk to be deposed by her own daughter, the example of which we see quite a lot in the kind of old history, if you go beyond Central Asia. So it seems actually this relationship between Gulnara and Karimov himself represent the case when the rulers actually can rely totally on the members of his own family. And so actually it's highlighting the risk of being reliant exclusively on the kind of own daughters or the sons. And something maybe after a certain period of time, Rakhmonov himself actually may also face something similar to the situation in Uzbekistan. So, and it's also actually highlight the fact that the circle and the number of options for Karimov actually shrinking down rapidly. It's something probably, if not each, that many authoritarian rulers actually going to face over a certain period of time when they have less and less people they could rely on in terms of loyalty.
Right. The idea to appoint immediate family members to high positions, at least from those president's point of view, is to secure their grip on power. But when it does not work out, like it happened in Uzbekistan's case, it turns very nasty. The same thing was repeated in Kazakhstan, right, Bruce, with Rakhit Aliyev being in a fierce battle with Nazarbayev at some point, and we know how it ended tragically later.
Yeah, the case of Rakhit Aliyev is should be something that all the Central Asian leaders are looking at, because here was a person who had came from a medical training background, and he was obviously clearly a very ambitious person. He made his way up the ladder in the government with the help of his father-in-law. But his father-in-law, or certainly Kazakhstan's prosecutor general, said that he got to the point where Rakhit Aliyev was planning to overthrow his father-in-law and take that position himself. We know that he had huge amounts of money. We know that he had control over all sorts of different sectors of Kazakhstan's economy, the media, on and on. And so this was an example of someone who was, like I said, it gets back to his ambition. He was more ambitious than Nazarbayev had assessed him to be when he started giving him these positions. I would do Kyrgyzstan too, if I could, just for a moment, because that's the example of a family thing that did not work twice. That we had Askar Akayev in, and while Kyrgyzstan is obviously something of a different example in Central Asia, but still, Akayev's rule was going on like all the leaders. But when it got to the point where his children started to get posts, that's when he really started to run into trouble. And we remember the 2005 revolution. The problem started right away. First, there was a story that the prime minister, Nikolai Tanayev at the time, had held this secret meeting and decided that they were going to have, when parliamentary elections came up, they were going to have mostly pro-Akayev candidates that would win the elections. And that would secure the presidential elections, which were scheduled later for the year, and get Akayev back into power, or certainly someone who thought like Akayev. But Akayev's daughter, Bermet, and his son, Aydar, both started running for the post. And in Bermet's case, she was running in the same district as Rosa Otunbayeva, who was disqualified immediately from running because of residency questions. And then when both the kids won, and Prime Minister Tanayev's son was also running in that election, I think there was a lot of problems in Kyrgyzstan anyway, but that just seemed to be too much for the Kyrgyz people to accept anymore. And later we saw the same thing with Bakiyev and his son Maxim. And Kermanbek Bakiyev, the former president, had given security post to his brother, and all of a sudden he'd put his 33-year-old son at the time or something in charge of the whole Kyrgyz economy. Mm-hmm. And in both cases it did not work. And that's what led to the revolution.
Right.
That's my point, Steve. I'm coming to you. These family feuds are fundamentally against the idea behind this nepotism first place, right? I mean, in first place, why the president would bring some of his immediate family members to a circle to strengthen his position, right? But now suddenly you see this kind of family feud starting, like in case of Uzbekistan, in case of Kazakhstan, and Bruce mentioned some examples in Kyrgyzstan. What goes wrong? I mean, where does it start?
Right. No, I think it's that contradiction that we're talking about that is so interesting, that, as Catherine said, it's an attempt of, to consolidate power, and these family feuds, and also just the misdeeds and really embarrassing and ridiculous things that the kids do, actually does it often. Those are the incidents, those are the interactions and scandals and controversies that make these rulers look more vulnerable, or most vulnerable, than in any other point in their political careers, and their careers, at least in four out of the five, being dictators. And that's what's so interesting, is that when does Islam Karimov look vulnerable? He looks vulnerable when he's actually got to take the extreme step of putting his own daughter in house arrest and having his grandson out in the Russian media and the Western media, airing the dirty laundry of the family. That, from a Central Asian, traditional family values perspective, is an absolute scandal. I'm also thinking not only about, these stories that make the international headlines, but think about incidents of traffic accidents when children of the elite ministers, not just the president, but, the sons of, often the sons like to really drive fast cars down the main boulevard, Rudaki Boulevard in Dushanbe, or that, that's happened also in Bishkek. It's happened in Tashkent. And they'll get into these terrible catastrophes. People people will die, and they'll often get off. And I think ordinary Central Asians look at those incidents, and this is one thing where they really see the contradiction between, you know, the standards and rules that apply to ordinary people and the justice that applies to the children of the elite. And I think it engenders intense anger, sometimes protests, and these are the type of incidents that can really get out of control and bite the governments where it hurts the most.
Nepotism adds to that anger, obviously. Kathy, we need to wrap up the discussion, but from the examples of Uzbekistan, in Kazakhstan, to some extent Kyrgyzstan, what are the lessons for Tajikistan and Turkmenistan from those examples?
Well, I think the sort of place to start with that is that the seating the government with your relatives and the extended family works up until the point that it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it kind of falls apart in a grand fashion. You have these big scandals, as he was alluding to, you know, when the son of so-and-so minister crashes a car and kills somebody, he might not be held responsible, but a lot of people are very angry about it. And so I think it's sort of, it's a very tenuous way to hold on to power, because once one of those dominoes falls, the rest of it starts to kind of tumble together. And the case of sort of Gulnara and then what happened with Aliyev in Kazakhstan, just sort of, this might not be the best analogy, but it makes me think of The Godfather. And there's one point in The Godfather when Michael Corleone says to his older brother, you know, don't ever take sides against the family, ever. And it's sort of, that's sort of where the line is. I mean, I think you see that with Gulnara. She got too ambitious and too ostentatious. And really embarrassed Uzbekistan on a global scale, and that was too far. And so I think the lesson for Turkmenistan is sort of more opaque, so you're not really certain who's in what position and who's doing what. But the lesson for them, and then also Tajikistan, is that this isn't a sure bet on hanging on to power, and it's not 100% going to work that all of the members of your family that you instill in positions of power are going to do those jobs well. And the outcome of that is a lot of what you have now in Central Asia, which is, you know, stagnant economic policies and sort of lack of creativity when it comes to handling challenges. And that's because the people in power haven't had to sort of fight with their ideas to get to where they are. They've had to, you know, tap their patronage networks.
Right. Yeah, we are getting just to the end of our discussions. Briefly, please, Steve, your comments about the lessons from Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, to some extent Kyrgyzstan, to other two Central Asian countries.
Well, you know, I think human rights are placed at risk when anytime nepotism is allowed to, in this case, not just fester, but absolutely blossom and flourish for 20 years. It's what, unfortunately, has distinguished Central Asia from many of the other regions of the world, as, you know, one of its main exports being authoritarianism. You know, and that comes about through a lack of rule of law and exactly these sort of familial patronage structures. I think one important lesson, or one lesson, it's not so much to the other countries, but maybe to the wider international communities, We shouldn't have this discussion, I think, without mentioning at least the significance of the offshore element. You know, the fact that people like Gulnara have access to Swiss bank accounts, that was, you know, that occurred in many of the other cases here that Bruce has mentioned and Ali Sher has mentioned, that, you know, there's a responsibility on the part of banking institutions on places like, you know, the UK and the US that are conducting, now they're forced to conduct a lot of corruption investigations. But at the time that, you know, these banking schemes are used by these members of the family, a red flag should go up. You know, there should be other people weighing in, because this is actually not really a local phenomenon. It's an offshore, not only onshore, but offshore phenomenon. And I think that triggers some mechanisms, banking, financial mechanisms, to prevent corruption. You know, and it's pretty plain to see who the players are, because these networks are, you know, we mostly know who the players are, with the exception of Turkmenistan, as Catherine was mentioning. But I think, you know, the lesson is that you can only gradually get away from these systems of power by allowing democratic elections and upholding human rights and allowing a media to flourish. If you have journalists asking questions, then you're going to have a much healthier, you know, system of exchange, and power will be distributed more fairly. So I think the main lesson is uphold the law, follow the Constitution, promote human rights, and, you know, gradually we can hope to see this region move in the right direction.
Right. And there are obviously lessons for Central Asians, but also there is a lesson to learn, Bruce, for the international community.
To the best of their ability, they should be pressuring these governments to open up a little bit. You know, I'm going to go along with what Steve said and start following their own constitutions, for one thing. And I know that's asking a lot. But they need to have qualified people ready to replace the current leadership, because the current leadership is in power for the most part solely because they have been in power since the Soviet Union fell apart. You cannot expect, there's not much loyalty from the people to the leaders of these countries as it is. And so there's nothing for the people to transfer their loyalty onto now. And that's going to be a big issue. And there's, you know, if we had a qualified people, that a person that was respected that could assume the role of leadership, that would be one thing. But they're going to get someone who was thrown in there who's a relative or a good friend of the current leader, and who are not, and the current leadership is not popular. So.
Right. Alisher, final words from you?
The lessons, actually, I would, focus on one key word is stability. You know, it's looking at the situation through the prism of these developments evolving towards this nepotism, clinging to power. We see that how unstable the situation. And therefore, the international stakeholders should realize they're dealing not with the kind of state and state institutions, but with some peculiar kind of formation where the family and the state structures are merging with each other, and which making this quasi-state, quite unreliable partners, you know, and not being able to deliver in terms of, providing genuine stability. What now is saving the situation for Uzbekistan, for instance, is not the way how they managing affairs, but, for instance, labor migration. But now we see the sinking economy in Russia making the situation in Uzbekistan very, very much vulnerable, actually. So it remains to see what happened over a certain period of time with this all kind of cherished political stability. And in Kazakhstan, it was based very much on kind of hydrocarbons.
Nice.
And now with prices going down for oil and gas, so we see some signs already kind of growing instability.
Mm-hmm.
And the way how the Nazarbayev responding is just creating a cult of his personality.
Right.
It's following the same kind of way as the same, Rahmon, not educated. The educated Nazarbayev becoming very much akin to the Rahmon with his kind of rural, uneducated background.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, Alisher Ilhamov, researcher at the London School of Oriental and African Studies, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Steve Sverdlo, Human Rights Watch, Central Asia researcher, and Catherine Putz, editor of Central Asian section at The Diplomat. Thank you very much for joining us, colleagues, for this discussion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.